Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Steve Jobs did not let his own kids use iPads, and our guest today says Jobs was far from alone. Many Silicon Valley superstars do the same, preventing their own progeny from becoming addicted to the very screens whose addictive qualities have made them rich. We're talking this hour with Adam Alter, a psychology and marketing professor at New York University and author of the new book, Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. Alter says it's no surprise. We can't seem to stop clicking, liking, checking, and gaming. These products, he says, are designed to keep us staring. That's how they make money. Still, Alter is not saying you should go throw your phone in the river. Instead, he advocates what he calls sustainable screen use. And we'll find out more this hour in The Exchange. So let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Adam Alter, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
Well, let's just start right up front with this, Adam. What's your own screen addiction?
My biggest problem is email. I can't go to bed at the end of the day unless I've checked all my emails, and sometimes that means hundreds a day, and I know that keeps me from doing more important things.
All your emails? That sounds almost
pretty
impossible.
Much. It's a Sisyphean task. Basically, every day I wake up and I have more, and I keep going until the end of the day, and at night I'll spend sometimes an hour or two trying to check them all off. And once I've dealt with them, I'll wake up the next day and do it all over again.
So why do you do that?
I wish I had a great answer for you. But to me, there's this movement known as Inbox Zero. And I am unwittingly, I don't mean to be, but I just happen to be an adherent. And what that means is that at the end of the day, you need to make sure that your inbox has no new emails. And for whatever reason, that's my goal. I set that goal. It's very counterproductive because it's obviously not the most important thing in the world. But I'm well known for being an incredibly quick responder to email.
The last part of the title of your book, Adam, and I think we're getting at this with your own story, is, Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology. Here's the part I want to ask you about, though, the business of keeping us hooked. So what does that mean?
Yeah, I'm a business school professor, so the business angle is very interesting to me. And what I found as I started to do more and more research into this idea of screen addiction was that a lot of what we're consuming is by design meant to be addictive. It's created in such a way, I'm not sure that the people who create it would say we're trying to make you addicted because that's such a loaded term, but they want you to be engaged and they measure success by how long you spend using their products, how often you come back, how much time you spend each time you log on to a social network, for example. And so it's really part of the business, it's baked into the business that you should be spending as much time using these experiences or these devices as possible.
So their success, their profitability, is measured on us staying as long as possible, even if that's to our detriment.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the big reasons for that is that advertising dollars are tied to how much time people spend on any platform. And a lot of these devices and platforms run on advertising dollars. So it's very important to them that you spend a lot of time with these platforms. And also, you spend more money on those platforms the more time you spend. So this all is borrowed from the world of slot machines, where the designers of slot machines use a term known as time on device to measure how long you spend in front of the slot machine on average. And the best slot machines in any casino are the ones that get you to sit there for the longest without leaving.
Okay, so give us a little more there. Based on slot machines, so what is it? Is it the sound? Is it the lights? Is it the shapes? Is it the rewards at the end of the day? What is it?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is the rewards. That's certainly, I think, the primary driver. Basically, what happens is We often assume that if you know you're going to get a reward, you'll work very hard to attain that reward and to obtain the reward. And that's what people do much of the time. It turns out that uncertainty baked into any experience makes us work that much harder. So there's a lot of evidence from lower order animals, pigeons, rats and monkeys, and then even evidence with humans. You can see this with gambling. You can see it with people who play the lottery, that if you bake uncertainty into any experience, people will play it for longer, they'll be more engaged for longer, and it's a huge part of social networking, it's a huge part of many of these screen experiences, because when you send something out into the world, you don't know what you're going to get back.
So I see what you're talking about when it comes to games. You know, you have to reach the next level and mm-hmm. you get more points and so forth. But what about social networking? I mean, some of it just seems like a nice way to, you know, look at your cousin's photos from her vacation.
Yeah, and it certainly is that for many people. There are other reasons that make just sort of lurking, as people term it, interesting and engaging. But every time you send content out into the social networking world, there's a lot of uncertainty. You don't know if anyone will engage, and if they do, will they engage positively or negatively? Will they criticize you? Will you get one like or three likes or 100 likes? Will you get one share, no shares, 100 shares? Basically, that uncertainty makes the process of sharing parts of ourselves a very, it's basically a little bit anxiety provoking. And that anxiety is quite addictive in a sense. We find it irresistible.
So you're a little anxious when you put the photos up and then you kind of wait and then you say, oh, I got 300 likes. This is great. I'm awesome. It's
yes,
gratifying.
Absolutely. It's gratifying. But what's important is that, you know, you might get a 300 like share, but then you'll also post something the next day and you'll get nothing. No one will engage. And that is really important. You need those posts to fail to make the ones that succeed so hard to resist. And it's that process of uncertainty and resolving the uncertainty sometimes in your favor and sometimes not that makes the process of being engaged with social media so hard to resist.
So the producers are the stuff we consume on screens, whether it's, you know, and we'll break down into the different categories later. But for now, you know, whether it's Instagram or Snapchat or a game, they're all using some of the same psychology behind very successful gambling machines. That seems to be what you're saying, Adam.
Yeah, to a large extent. I mean, Facebook made this incredibly important and very wise decision a few years after it was launched. Mark Zuckerberg decided that it was really important to have a like button. The like button changed the psychology of Facebook dramatically. Until that point, the content was static. You were reading about things that people had posted sometimes weeks or months before. But the like button and this news feed that was constantly being updated meant that the whole process was much more dynamic. And just as every time you pull the handle on a slot machine, you don't know what's going to come up, the like button meant that people could respond in real time. And there is nothing more interesting to humans than how other humans think of them.
So we know a lot now, too, Adam, about brain science. And this has been really exciting in the last couple of decades. We know so much more about how our brains work. How has that helped the creators of these products to latch onto our brains even more tightly?
Well, it's pretty complicated, but the most simple way of describing it is that what happens when you do something that's pleasurable, and it doesn't have to be something addictive, it can even be, say, a child eating ice cream, is there's a great amount of dopamine produced in the brain, which then is that binds to certain receptors, and that feeling, that produces a feeling of intense pleasure in people, at least initially. You can develop a tolerance where you need more and more of that dopamine, and that's where addiction takes hold, and that's why we ramp up our dosage of things that we're addicted to, whether they're experiences or substances. But what that means is if you put people in a scanner or you measure the amount of dopamine being produced in their brains, you can see which areas of the brain are active. There are areas known as the reward centers. And if you present a particular experience to them, you could see that in the one case, the reward center is very active, and in another, less so. And we know based on that, that people are more likely to develop greater engagement with that experience. And so there are neuromarketing companies that do a lot of this sort of work, especially with advertising, but to some extent with experiences as well. And they will measure your brain responses to different activities.
Okay, hang on. Neuromarketing. So
yes.
Give us a little more on that.
Well, it's basically the process of putting people, sometimes they'll be hooked up to machines that measure the electrical activity in the brain. Sometimes it'll be about blood flow in the brain. And they'll basically watch as you engage with some experience. It could be a slot machine. It could be a video game. It could be an advertisement. And what they'll maybe do is show you different versions of the game or advertisement or experience. And they'll look at how your brain responds. They'll also look at what your eyeballs are doing. Are you staring intently or are you looking off to the side because you're a little bit bored? Are you sweating a little bit more? Are you sweating less? Because sweating is a sign of engagement. And, you know, they'll put all of this together. And from that, they will be able to say to companies and people producing experiences and ads, this is the version that you should pursue. And so a lot of it relies on this sort of brain science and the science of human psychology and physiology.
So let's say I'm a game designer and I've got 5 different prototypes of my game. I bring in a couple people, I hook them up to all sorts of wires, and then I measure the amount of, you know, sweat or eyes widening, as you said, or heart rate, or maybe I even can check out the dopamine levels in their brain. I don't know if that's possible. And then I say, oh, okay, prototype number 3 seems to get the most out of these people, so we're going with that.
Yeah, basically. The best way, I think, though, and this is what most companies do, is they move away from brain science and they just focus on behavior. Mm-hmm. Because the best way to measure addiction is to see how long people spend engaged with the experience. So they might release these 10 different versions of any mission in a game, for example. Let's say it's a game with millions of players. Some of them will see one version of a mission and some will see another. And you just look at how long on average those players engage with the game. Do they play the mission for an average of 2.5 hours or 4 hours? And if you keep iterating that process, you keep whittling down, so you keep picking the best version based on that measure, say 10 generations later, you'll have gone through this process of whittling down, eliminating the parts that are less engaging and keeping the ones that are more engaging. You have this kind of weaponized version of that mission or game by the end, by that 10th generation, and it's very hard to resist at that point.
The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Do you feel you have a bit of a digital addiction, or do you feel like everybody else around you has a digital addiction? Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Adam Alter. His book is Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. And he's explaining how companies of these products that we consume online purposefully make them so that we just can't turn away. 1-800-892-6477. Again, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Adam, how fair is it, though, to blame the companies? What about individual free will? You just say to yourself, okay, after an hour on this game or after 15 minutes of Facebook or email, using your own example, you know, just say to yourself, time to shut it off now. I'm a grown-up. I've got stuff to do. I've got dinner to make. I need to go for a walk, you know, whatever.
You know, that's the sort of claim you could make about pretty much any addictive activity or behavior. You could say that about drug use or nicotine, but I think, or gambling. But I think what we need to do is to look at how many people who engage with these experiences develop these addictions or tendencies to keep going when they shouldn't, when it starts to harm their well-being. Now, we're all human. We are fallible. We only have so much willpower. If you put something in front of someone and there's an 80% chance or a 50% chance that they won't be able to stop using it, I think at that point, some of the responsibility certainly sits with the person using it, but some of it has to rest on the people who put it out there in the world. You can use the analogy of big tobacco, for example. You know, we don't say that the people who take up smoking and can't stop smoking for years of their lives because they develop serious nicotine addictions, we don't say it's all about them. We say, actually, it turns out that big tobacco is a little bit to blame here as well, or a lot to blame. And so as norms shift, we start to see the producers of these experiences or substances as blameworthy as well. And I think we are early on in that process with technology. We still rest most of the blame on the people who use tech. I think that will change, and I think it should over time.
You got to give us a little more there because, again, I think a lot of people listening to you, Adam, would say, no, just shut it off. It's not that hard. You know, grow up.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. There's a study that looks at how many people have developed a behavioral addiction over the past 12 months. And the study was run in 2011, which is really a lifetime ago in the world of tech and screens.
Right.
At that point, 41% of adults in the past year had a behavioral addiction. Today, the estimates are that it's probably over 50% because we've had more widespread adoption of vehicles that deliver addictive experiences like iPads and screens and tablets. So If 50% of the population has developed an addiction to these experiences, according to scientific research, I think we're at the point where we have to at least consider the possibility that the companies that produce this tech should at least be mindful of what they're doing as they release products into the world that sometimes billions of people use. So yes, personal responsibility is key, but I think at some point you have to say if 50% of people who engage have a problem, and a lot of us have no choice but to engage given this tech-driven world we're in, I think some of the blame must rest with the companies as well.
Okay, so here's a real-life example of what you're saying. Horrible story over the weekend. 13 people killed in Texas by a young man who was texting. 13 right. lives were taken because someone was texting. I just, you know, I can't even get over the just stupidity and tragedy of that. So given what you're saying, Adam, is the young man responsible or is the phone that, you know, maybe made him addicted to texting responsible? Because I think most people would say it's his fault. Don't blame the phone. Yeah. He didn't have to do that.
Yeah, no, he certainly didn't. You know, this wouldn't have happened if he hadn't been texting at the time. I think it's a much more nuanced conversation than whose fault is it. The simple truth is you should not be texting when you're driving. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that. The ideal in the ideal world is that people don't text. And yet if you ask teenagers and you ask even adults, the vast majority of them have at one point or another texted at a time when they shouldn't have been. But I do think the responsibility essentially rests with the texter, the individual who's doing that. But, you know, the fact that there are these products out there that despite our ability to say, I know I shouldn't be doing this and yet I keep doing it anyway, the fact that those products exist suggests that at least we should have a conversation about their role in society, about the way we approach them and consider them. You know, there are certain things we would never allow people to do when they're driving because they are so dangerous. And I think texting is becoming one of those things, but it's still a little bit early on and the norms haven't quite evolved to that point yet and people still do it.
Well, there are laws everywhere that say don't do it, and yet people do still do it. So you do wonder, you know, highway deaths are up. Officials say screens are a big part of this. There are laws everywhere, but it doesn't seem to be very effective.
That's true. I mean, think about people who drive when they're drunk. We have a much firmer and harsher view of those people than we do of people texting. I'm not talking about the ones who kill people because they've been careless when they're driving. I'm talking about just everyday people. Like if someone says to you, oh, I went driving the other day and I was absolutely drunk, you feel differently about that person from someone who says, oh, I went driving the other day and I sent a quick text. That's just because the norms, I think, are a little bit different. We do see that both are wrong, but I think the idea of driving when you're very drunk is seen as a different thing. And yet the evidence suggests that they're both terrible for your attentional resources. They drain you dramatically and they make you a much poorer driver. They increase the risk of having accidents by a similar amount. So that just suggests that it's more about our attitudes. The tech is newer. We haven't got to that point yet. But I agree with you. Essentially, this is a matter of personal responsibility.
So what incentive is there for companies to make their products less addicting? Because, you know, they make less money that way and that's what they're all about. They're responsible for their shareholders, their employees and so
forth. No, I totally agree with you. And honestly, there isn't. There isn't much incentive. You're effectively telling the companies that they need to make a less addictive and less engaging version that will make them less money. Google, for a while, had a person working there who was known as their design ethicist. And his original role was really more sort of a philosopher in chief. You know, he was thinking about what the philosophy behind Google's products was. But he evolved in his role and he became a guy who would go into meetings and say, look, I think we should think about how people will feel when they're using this product and the fact that they won't be able to engage with loved ones and it'll take them out of the here and now. He started to make suggestions. He's no longer at Google because he says he ran into inertia. That's the word he used. In other words, the company will only go so far in dialing down how engaging their products are because it's bad business, which is why I think we need to start considering things like regulation or at least thinking about how the norms need to evolve, that we should treat these companies to some extent the way we treat companies that release other products that are hard for us to resist or that are addictive. If they're making us less well off and they're harming our well-being in some sense, I think they should be held to account, even if they won't do it voluntarily.
You can't say to Wall Street, though, you know, hey, my platform is going to make the choice to reduce the number of users who look at it every day. So come on and invest in me, Wall Street, okay?
You can't. Absolutely agree.
It's not a great business strategy, but we will talk a lot more about that in just a minute. And we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Diane Leigh Beck's latest novel about a woman lost in the woods explores the nature of love.
People expect it to be this great emotional high. Is love like that, or is it common? And if love is common, you know, what's so great about it?
I'm Peter Biello. The novel Breaking Wild is now out in paperback. Leigh Beck discusses her book on the bookshelf from NHPR. Find this podcast and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how our digital devices keep us hooked and what to do about it. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guest is the author of the new book, Irresistible, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. Adam Alter joins us from New York. And Adam, let's go right to our listeners. And Jason is in Manchester. Hi, Jason. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing? I'm listening to this, and it occurs to me that people have been unfolding maps and balancing newspapers and eating cheeseburgers behind the wheel of a car. Is this just juvenile, or is this the same technology, just getting better?
What's juvenile, Jason? Is that what you said?
Just fear of anything new or young or youthful. You know, it's always easy to blame the kids, isn't it?
I'm so glad you called, Jason, because you do talk about that in the book, Adam. It's easy to think that the world 20 years ago was perfect.
Yes, it is. And we do that. I mean, no matter what new technology comes around, we blame it for something. We've done that with TV and pinball machines and pretty much anything that comes around. I think there are things that are different about the current tech. One of the biggest things is that it goes with us absolutely everywhere. It's portable. If you ask 70% of people, can you at any moment in the day, 24 hours a day, reach your phone without moving your feet? 70% of them will say, yes, I can, at any moment of the day, including when they're asleep. That's something that's new and different. So where you had to stop using things like video game consoles, and when a newspaper, you eventually got to the end of it, these are devices that are bottomless, that we use all the time, that are always with us. And as a result, the consequences of using them are graver. They're much more extreme than I think for a lot of other tech.
You also said before the break, Adam, that screen addiction is making us less well off. That's subjective, though, isn't it? I mean, I may feel perfectly fine, and you may say, gosh, your lifestyle is really, you know, too much focused on screens, Laura. I mean, how do you define that?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a large extent, it is subjective. If you say to me that you are only happy with your use and you never have any issues at the dinner table and you never find that you're using your phone when you'd rather connect with other people, then you're not someone with a problem, because inherent in this definition of behavioral addiction is the idea that in the long run, this thing that you can't stop doing now is bad for you. Some people will say that it's not bad for them, and that's great. But what's interesting is when you interview people, and this is everyone from teenagers up to older adults, they will say the same thing. The vast majority say at various points, phones, screens, technology gets in the way of their social lives and their ability to connect with other people. That's not even starting to talk about the physical or psychological consequences or financial consequences. This example of people texting because they can't stop using their phones and then having accidents, whoever is responsible for that, that is an example of someone doing something they shouldn't be doing that has negative consequences for their well-being. So not everyone all the time using tech has problems, and I think tech is miraculous and wonderful a lot of the time. It just so happens that a lot of us have trouble at least some of the time.
Jason, thank you for that call. Again, the number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Rachel's in Kittery, Maine. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, so there's been a lot of attention on you being extremely susceptible to addiction. Well, my question is are there other segments of the population that are especially susceptible to technological addiction?
Thank you, Rachel, for the call. And I think if you had a hard time hearing her over the phone line, Adam, she was saying we're focusing on youth, but what about other segments of the population? And your book is not just like, ooh, kids today. I mean, you're talking about everybody.
I am, yeah. What's really fascinating for me is how demographics are changing with respect to a lot of these kinds of tech use. You used to have the stereotype of gamers as, say, teenage boys in the basement playing a console on the TV. Now the biggest demographic of gamers, the biggest proportion of that demographic is middle-aged women. And that's because the nature of gaming has changed so much. It's now about these games that we play for 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there on our phones that sort of become entangled in our everyday lives. So what's really interesting is that there is no single demographic here. People talk about an addictive personality, and there's some evidence that people who are more risk-seeking tend to develop addictions more readily. But we're talking here about forms of engagement that affect 50 or more percent of the population. At that point, when it's a majority of the population, those demographic markers, things like youth and gender and things like that, kind of go out the window.
So we used to think that it was mostly, you know, young men getting addicted to social media platforms or games or whatever. But now you're saying it's just basically everybody.
Pretty much. I mean, it cuts across the demographics. It's true about older adults. It's true about younger adults. It's true about teens. It's almost the same with kids as well, even young kids who are younger than teenage years.
Well, what's the harm of a middle-aged woman sitting in a doctor's office, you know, and they often keep you waiting, so you play 10 minutes of Candy Crush. I mean, is that like a societal addiction? Is that really a problem?
Well, it's funny. So, you know, there are ways of asking that question. One of the ways is to just ask, theoretically, is that an issue? Like, is it a problem for us as a sort of society?
Right.
In the main, I would say probably not. But when you interview these people and you talk to them, they all say, there are times when I wish I were not doing this thing or playing this game. And it's remarkable how almost universal that is. It's very common for people to say that they use these games, they use these experiences much more than they'd like to. So I think it is certainly an issue. But of course, you know, like there are now virtual reality headsets that are given to people as they board certain airlines. Now, if you have to sit through a 6-hour flight and you can do it by imagining you're on a beach in Greece, I would argue that's a great use of technology. but once you start doing that instead of engaging with other people, then it's not so great. So it really is a question of when and how and in what context we're using these experiences as escapes.
Thank you for the call, Rachel. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Nancy sent us an email, Adam. She says, I agree that screens are addictive, more to some than others. Our school requires kids to use computers for their homework and schoolwork starting at grade 5. We've worked hard to build digital discipline with our 10-year-old son, but I feel like it has been undermined by the school. Any ideas to help us? Nancy, thank you for the email.
Yeah, it's a great question. And there are schools that are very mindful of this. So one really interesting one is the Waldorf School of the Peninsula in the Bay Area in California. What's really interesting about this school is they don't introduce tech until 8th grade. And when they do, it's known as slow tech. And it's basically teaching kids how to code, how to design apps, instead of just being a vehicle for teaching general education. 75% of the kids who go to that school are the children of Silicon Valley tech execs. So even the tech execs know that this is an issue. And I think it's absolutely right to be concerned about this to some extent. There's evidence that kids learn better when they're using pens and paper than when they're using screens. They just engage more and they encode more deeply. So I think these are legitimate concerns. It's something worth talking to the school about. I wouldn't worry too much about it. Kids are capable of learning even when they're using screens. But the best thing you can do is you could set a boundary between what they're doing at school and what they do at home. So if they're spending many hours a day at school using screens, it's not the end of the world, but you probably want to make sure that there are strict boundaries at home regarding when they do and don't use screens, say from 5 to 7 p.m., something like that.
So this is really interesting because a lot of the schools in New Hampshire have been spending a lot of money getting iPads or Chromebooks into the schools. They're incorporated into the curriculum. They're a way for kids to share documents on Google Docs or whatever. So at least in the Concord School District, which is the district I know the best, there's been a real push to bring iPads and Chromebooks into the classroom. You're saying research shows, Adam, that kids learn better with pen and paper?
Yeah, they do. There's no doubt about that. I'm convinced of that. I do think there's a mistake in saying that all screen use is the same and for condemning
Absolutely.
Schools for bringing in screens. So, you know, like as I mentioned, this Waldorf school brings in screens for slow tech use. Now, if it's a utility, if you're using a screen for usefulness, and let's say it's for something like sharing documents, and that allows you to use Dropbox or some other program that allows, or Google Docs that allows document sharing, I think there's good reason to do that. It's when the screen becomes a standalone thing that you are using to convey new information. Instead of like having a teacher stand up in front of people and say, taking notes, which is what we still do, I can say in my MBA and undergraduate classes, we still do that. We ask everyone to put their screens away and they use pen and paper. They do tend to learn much better in those situations.
Learn better in that the information stays in your brain. There's something about the pen and the paper and the brain, they're all connected?
Yeah, what's going on? When it turns out that people are much faster at typing than they are at writing today.
Right.
And what that means is that when you are writing things down, you are forced to digest the information and decide which parts are important before you basically store it in long-term memory. And what that means is you encode the information much more deeply in memory and can then retrieve it better. Like if I just said to you, if I said 100 words right now and you wrote those very same 100 words down or typed them down, you'd have a very hard time remembering the gist of that. But if I said 100 words really fast and you were forced to digest it before writing it down or typing it, you would do a much better job of remembering it. And that's what goes on more often when we're writing because we're slower. We're forced to digest the information first.
Let's take another call. And Steve's in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome. And I think we lost Steve. Hopefully, Steve, you will call back. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is great, exchange@nhpr.org. Nancy, thanks for that one. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter as well if you like, NHPR Exchange. You know, we've been talking a lot about kids and schools and people using their phones when they're driving. They absolutely should not. What about at the workplace, Adam? I mean, NHPR could not in any way, shape, or form say, you know what, folks, don't use your email or your computers today. I mean, we just couldn't do that. So how do you find that blend of using technology at work but not letting it get out of control?
Yeah, it's an excellent point, right? I mean, it's one of the things that makes behavioral addiction and tech addiction so different from substance addiction. There's no place for substance addiction in the workplace, but you have to engage with tech in the workplace. When you travel, when you communicate, it's just very hard to go off email and off tech completely. And so that makes it much more tricky. We have to strike up a balance. We have to use a sustainable approach. And that's especially true in the workplace. You know, I think a lot of the change has to come from the workplace itself or even from a higher level government organization. And what I mean by that is, if you look at a lot of countries in Western Europe are now doing, there are laws that stipulate that, for example, any company in France with over 50 employees has to have a charter that explains how the employees will be protected from email between, I think it's 6 p.m. and 8 a.m. So it's sort of baked into the way that company works. And there's a similar thing in Germany. So a number of companies in Germany have this wonderful email vacation policy, which is that every time you get an email, if you're on vacation, there's an automatic reply that says, thank you for your email. It has been automatically deleted. It will not be sent to this person. You have the, which is pretty striking.
Seriously?
And what you're told is you can forward it on to this other person who's not on vacation, or you can resend it to this person when they're back from vacation.
And leave what that this does person is alone.
Leave them alone. And if you're that person, the worst thing about email when you're on vacation is wondering what your email inbox will look like when you finish that vacation. And
right.
That causes people to keep checking. But here, the great thing about this policy is your inbox will look identical the day you come back to how it did the day you left. And so there's no reason to check your email, and people report being able to actually take a vacation.
I don't even know what to say about that. I just can't imagine that flying in this country. I mean, some people may think that's what makes America the, you know, amazing society that it is. We are on it. We work hard. We're there 24/7. Look at our economy. Look at our tech. Look at our industries. We're vibrant. We're moving. We're going places. That just doesn't seem to fit with the American psyche.
It doesn't. And we may believe that. And certainly we are very vibrant. We are very engaged. We don't know how to disengage, actually. But what's really interesting is that these employees are more productive for their disengagement from email. There's a really interesting statistic, actually, that on average, 70% of workplace emails are checked within 6 seconds of arriving. And once you check an email, it will take you 20 to 25 minutes to get back into the same level of engagement with the task you were in before that email arrived. Which means that companies that force you to keep checking email to always be on top of what's coming in through your inbox are causing you never to really be in your zone of maximum productivity, which is obviously bad for those companies. No matter whether there's this illusion that we're always plugged in and that's a good thing, we're actually not as dialed in as we should be to the tasks we're doing outside of email. And I think that's a bad thing.
That's really interesting. So counterintuitive, the employee who is not always online, connected, checking everything all the time, that seems like the really super efficient, super engaged employee, but that's actually not the employee who is maximizing his or her productivity.
Yeah, right. I mean, email is almost never the core task. It's a way of communicating. It's a way of sharing information. But it's rarely like the bread and butter of what you do at work. And therefore, whatever that bread and butter is, whether you're designing something, being creative, writing, reading, whatever it may be, you are not going to do any of those things to your maximum potential if you're too engaged with email. So the best thing to do is to batch emails. I mean, something that some companies are doing is they're saying, we will release emails to you once every 2 hours, and then you'll get a block of emails. And that means that instead of going every 30 seconds and checking a new email and never being really engaged, you'll have 2 hours at a time where you can do all your other tasks knowing that you won't have an email. And then you can deal with emails in a block. It makes you much more efficient as a worker and actually much happier.
Let's go back to our listeners. And I think Steve in Nottingham is back. Go ahead, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. And I love what you're talking about. I'm a psychology teacher right now, and we talk about dopamine in the psychology course, and he's talking about the addiction quality. And my concern is that my students are addicted to their cell phones rather than their class, and the dopamine is working for their brains but not in their textbooks. And I am appalled by their inability to actually listen to a lecture without being on their phone. And it's not only they do not learn, but it's incredibly disrespectful.
So, Steve, do you have a policy in your class of,
absolutely,
shut it off?
You are on your cell phone, you're asked to leave.
Yeah.
That is my policy. And first of all, they do not read any textbooks anymore. They only go to Dr. Google for any information they need. So the cell phone has taken over their entire life.
Okay. Well, Steve, thank you for calling in. And boy, a couple thoughts and threads there for you, Adam. I'm picking up on one thing he said. He feels like it's disrespectful.
Yeah. And we all do. We all feel that, I think. When you sit at a table with someone and you're trying to engage with them, or if you're a teacher, one interesting thing about being a teacher actually is that when you're standing up in front of a room, it doesn't actually matter how many people there are in that room. You know what's going on. You can tell which people are on their phones. There's this illusion of transparency when you're sitting in a seat in a room. You think that you're transparent, no one can see what you're doing. But it turns out the teacher knows, and there's no other way to put it other than to say that it is disrespectful.
So here's the thing. Okay, so if you've got kids, you can say to them, look, I'm talking to you, sir, put the phone away. But I've been in several situations with friends who, they'll pull it out while maybe you're having dinner or you're walking downtown and, talking and you think engaging. And then, turns out your friend is looking at Facebook while she's walking downtown with you. How do you say that to a fellow adult? Like, be with me now, please.
I think it's very hard. I think the best thing you can do is just have a general policy that you have in place pretty much any time you're in certain situations. And what that means is, for example, have a little basket. Whenever you're at the dinner table, every phone goes in the basket. The basket goes far away from the table. It's that simple. So you don't in the moment have to chide someone and say, hey, you're on your phone. Can you not do that? You just basically head that issue off at the pass by having some policy in place. And I've tried this with friends.
Do you do this?
I know people who have. Yeah, it works really well. Everyone loves the idea. They hate the idea in the moment when an email seems absolutely essential. But if you do it before you start engaging, when there isn't actually an email to check, most people are like, you know what? That sounds like a great idea. That's one of those times when dialing back technology is a great idea and almost everyone agrees. Now, if you have a friend who's a surgeon or someone who absolutely needs to check their email, that's a different story. But so much of the time, it's things that are inessential that don't need to be done in that moment, and people are happy to wait.
All right. I'm going to pick on that in just a minute after a short break and imagine myself putting that basket in the middle of the kitchen in my own home. We've got a lot more calls, too. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More on the rise of addictive technology and the business of keeping us hooked in just a minute. This is The Exchange.
Diane Leigh Beck's latest novel about a woman lost in the woods explores the nature of love.
People expect it to be this great emotional high. Is love like that, or is it common? And if love is common, you know, what's so great about it?
I'm Peter Biello. The novel Breaking Wild is now out in paperback. Leigh Beck discusses her book on the bookshelf from NHPR. Find this podcast and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Adam Alter. He's author of the new book, Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. Adam Alter is also a professor of psychology and marketing at New York University's Stern School of Business, where he writes about social psychology and human cognition. And Adam, let's go right back to our listeners. And Hal is in Montpelier, Vermont. Hi, Hal. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you for my call. I wanted to touch base on the financial addiction side of electronics. A few years ago, I used to play a game, and after about 4 or 5 months and putting $1,600 into it, I realized it was more like a gambling addiction, and ended up stopped playing for a couple of years anyway, and got right back into it. I don't know if it's a lonely aspect of like socialization or not, but I got back into playing couple other games a few months back, and just the amount of money that people put into the games is unreal, because one of the games I played recently, I think in the past month and a half, I put $1,200 to.
Wow.
And you could see how much other people grow in these games, but 10, 20 times more than what I put into. My son and I were looking up how much some of these games make per month, and some of them, trying to think of which ones they are. Clash of Clans, for example, makes $12 million a month.
Wow!
Just their people playing their games in the in-app purchases.
Sure. So when, yeah.
So like he was, it's just a subject that touches me, touches home, because when he was saying that the rewards, you know, once you put the money in, you feel the rewards of the growth of the game and everything else, and it can get quite addictive. And you start trying to rationalize with yourself, saying, "Oh, I'm not home long enough to play on a console, so I'll just spend what I would spend on a game that I would buy for home." And before you know it, you put quite a bit of money into it.
Sure. And just to explain to folks, you know, how these things work, like you mentioned Clash of Clans. So, Hal, correct me if I'm wrong. You start to play the game and it goes along for a while. But then in order to get to the next level, to get more goodies, to have more fun, you need to buy a card that allows you access to that next level. And that's where the money comes in, right?
Kind of. I mean, most of these games you can keep playing for free, but it just takes time. So
yeah.
Basically you're buying time.
Yeah.
So the faster you want to grow, the faster you want to get to where you want to be, you know, you're buying time.
It's a better experience if you put more money into it.
Kind of.
Hal, you mentioned something lonely. Did the game sort of help you if you're lonely? And I think that's really interesting.
Well, I think the reason why I touched on that is because I was listening to another program the other day about socialization of, like, lonely adults. And some of the things that people do to fulfill that loneliness is play online games, especially with online games that have multiple different live people playing. So
sure.
When I hop on these games, you know, it's real people that I'm actually talking to and interacting with. So it doesn't make you feel so out of the loop. But then when you take a step back and you look, you realize you're still at home, just on your phone or wherever, just on your phone, not actually socializing with a real person.
Well, Hal, let me jump in because you raise a couple interesting points. And let's pick up on the lonely piece, Adam, because you talk about this in the book and you say that if somebody is screen addicted, the way to get over that isn't to, you know, throw the screen in the river. It's to look at what's going on behind that addiction. And loneliness is a big part of it.
Exactly. Yeah. You really need to work out what is the psychological itch that this experience is scratching. And for a lot of people with these games with thousands or millions of people playing, it is this sense of community that sometimes isn't available in the real world. We live in a very sort of divided world at the moment. A lot of people feel that they're far from other people. It's hard to make new friends or to engage. And yet online, these platforms are just waiting for you. As soon as you join them, you are engaging with people instantly. And so for a lot of people, that psychological itch is loneliness that is being scratched. And so when people find that they're addicted because they find that there's a sense of community online, a lot of them try to cultivate real offline experiences that give them that sense of community. And, you know, it takes some effort, but there are things you can do to replace what you're getting on that game and to still have that sense that you're connected to other people.
Now, there's a very compelling story in the book about a young man. I can't remember his name, but he was, you know, seemed to have everything going for him, you know, sports and academics and so mm-hmm. forth. Then he went off to college. His parents were divorced. He felt a little bit lonely. He wasn't sure what was going on. Maybe he didn't see his dad as much as he might have needed to. And so here's this bright, successful, oriented young man, and he kind of got sucked into World of Warcraft and didn't have an easy time of it.
He didn't, no. He was a straight-A student, and he was on the football team. He was really, you know, the last candidate you'd imagine would be addicted to this game. He had so much going for him in the real offline world, but he explained that he felt lonely. He'd immigrated from Venezuela when he was young, and he'd never really found a good, strong community of friends. And the minute he joined World of Warcraft, he found that. He found it instantly. He basically joined a guild of players who all banded together to play missions together. And he found that it was almost like going to war. You know, it was the band of brothers. And when he had friends who were playing in other parts of the world, he might have wanted to sleep, but because they were still playing, he felt it was his duty as a fellow, you know, person in this war to go in with them and engage in battle. And so he ended up not sleeping. At one point, he played for 5 weeks straight with only an hour of sleep each night.
Oh, my
he
goodness.
He paid the doorman. Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible thing. He paid the doorman at his dorm at university to bring up pizzas 3 times a day.
Oh.
And so he had this tower of pizza boxes that formed over that 5 week period. He missed 150 calls, put on 40 pounds of fat. He lost a lot of hair. He was very unhealthy. And eventually he picked up the 151st call, and it was his mom, and she came and collected him and took him to an internet addiction treatment center. And it took a couple of rounds of treatment, but ultimately he's recovered. He's doing very well now.
Well, it's interesting that you say that the multiplayer games, you know, when you feel like that's your platoon, you know, and you're bonded
yeah.
and you're responsible. But some people, you know, they see someone playing a multiplayer game, they think, well, at least he's socializing. You know, he's not just sort of in his own little zone or on his own little planet. So some people might say, oh, multiplayer game, at least you're engaging with human beings.
Yeah, I don't mean to diminish that. I think for a lot of people, that is a genuine form of social connection. When you talk to people who play games like World of Warcraft, they make really strong, solid friendships. I just think it's not ideal if that's the only way you spend your time, because it ends up crowding out other experiences. You know, this case I just described is a really clear-cut example where obviously there's nothing healthy about that experience, psychologically, physically, financially as well. He stopped going to school. It basically ruined a lot of other aspects of his life. But even people who play to a lesser extent, it can end up crowding out other aspects of their lives. There are a lot of stories of people who played World of Warcraft seeing their grades decline if they were at school, their friendships decline in the real world, and reporting a number of other issues. In fact, about 100 million people have played World of Warcraft, and by some measures, half of them have developed what a lot of people in the field would consider an addiction, which is why people say sometimes that World of Warcraft is probably the most addictive experience out there.
Well, thank you for the call again, Hal. Really appreciate it. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Reeves in Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. Go ahead. Welcome.
Hey, I'll be quick. First of all, this is an awesome show today. Laura, you're asking particularly brilliant questions today. And a really important topic. The Google ethicist that you mentioned, Adam, I believe that was Tristan Harris.
It was.
Well, I wanted to point out to people that he started an organization called Time Well Spent because he
yes.
is so concerned about the industry's deliberate effort to use our neurology to get us into addictions. So we're very concerned about the way the body responds to heroin. But we're not paying attention to the fact that the body responds exactly the same way as you've been describing to our tech pulses.
Very mm-hmm. interesting. Reeve,
thank you
very much. So the guy who was this Google ethicist and left, sounds like out of frustration, has started this timewellspent.org. Have you heard of this, Adam?
Yes, I have. It's timewellspent.io. It's Tristan Harris is his name. Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. He's proposed a Hippocratic Oath for designers of technology, which I think is such a great idea. So the Hippocratic Oath governs the way doctors and medical practitioners practice. And the idea is that above all else, you should do no harm to the people that you're practicing on or who your patients are. And I think that when you're producing tech that billions or hundreds of millions of people are likely to use, it's a really good first question to ask yourself. Am I essentially doing no harm to those people? And Harris proposed that, and it wasn't widely adopted, but I think it should be. And not only should it be adopted by businesses, but I think we as consumers of tech should start to demand that. That should be the norm. If you're going to send something out into the world that millions of people will be encouraged and ultimately probably compelled to use, then it should be designed so that it does no harm.
For example, a cell phone that shuts down while you're driving? I don't know. Is that too radical?
It sounds like a great idea. In fact, there are people who suggest that
or that doesn't allow you to text.
Should be, yeah, exactly. I think it's a really smart idea that when you are driving a car, you should hit a button and that basically disables the phone until you leave the car. I think that's a really wise idea.
Here's an email from Karen who says, Sweden, Canada, Australia, UK, Japan, to name a few, have banned cell phones used while driving, and it is strictly enforced. Hands-free is allowed in some places. Karen says this has dramatically reduced road deaths. Why is it not done here and enforced? Karen, thank you. So this is, again, the public policy piece that you mentioned earlier, Adam.
Yes, it is. I'm Australian, and that's true. It's frowned upon to use your phone in Australia in a way that I don't think it quite is here. It may be illegal here as well, and you may be encouraged or even compelled to use your phone's hands-free, but it's not practiced in quite the same way. So much of this, I think, rests on community norms and the way we perceive different behaviors. I think there are certain things, like using a phone at a dinner table in the US, it's frowned upon, but it's not seen as just, you know, rudeness of the highest order.
Gauche.
There are countries where that's the case. Yeah, mm-hmm. It doesn't quite rise to that level here yet. It may evolve to that point, and I think it probably will. But that's true. There are different norms in different countries and different rules, and I think we should try to ramp some of them up a little bit.
Well, we do have the laws on the books here in New Hampshire, but as Karen says, they are not really enforced. You see people all the time scrolling through Facebook, driving around town at least, but then you feel for the police. I mean, they've got an opioid crisis on their hands, and they've got all sorts of other stuff to do. So, you know, it's a lot to ask.
It is a lot to ask, yeah. I think that's why the norms are really important, because that's what people really respond to. It's interesting. One of the first things I studied when I was doing my PhD was the psychology of law and policing and crime. And people don't respond to laws just because there are laws. A lot of the time they flout the law. You know, to some extent they'll respond to deterrence. If they think they're going to be caught and there's a grave penalty, they'll do something about it. But much of the time, the most powerful thing is just the way society perceives that conduct or that act. I don't think we are sufficiently judgmental in general of people who use their phones and put others at grave risk. I think we haven't reached that point in the United States. In other countries, they have. And as a result, people tend not to do it as much.
Even though 13 people, again, 13 lives cut short by someone who admitted he was texting. That's not enough.
Well, I think most of the time when you text, nothing happens. That's the problem. And it's until that happens, it's just not seen as something that causes enough of a concern in that moment. We do a lot of things that we shouldn't do when we're driving. And that's because most of the time we're lucky. Nothing happens. But sometimes it does. And when it does, it can be grave.
You know, we've talked, Adam, a lot about email and trying different methods that countries and companies have used to make that less demanding or overwhelming. And we've talked a lot about games. You mentioned earlier Facebook and how once it instituted the like button, everything kind of changed. What changes might you suggest for social media sites like Facebook? Instagram is another one that you talk a lot about in the book. We haven't even gone to Snapchat yet. That's something that my children seem slightly addicted to, because if you don't keep on, you know, that streak, you know, then you're the one who ended the conversation. So what about those platforms? And would they even willingly consider, you know, making them less addictive? It doesn't seem to make business sense.
No, it doesn't. And it won't until the consumers make demands themselves. You know, a really good analogy, I think, is what's happened in green marketing. We now demand that companies show that they are being environmentally conscious in their behaviors. We don't accept companies that, you know, if there's a competitive landscape with five companies, if one of them dumps pollutants into water and the other company says we are creating new forests and planting trees, that's something we demand and we require, and we will go and send our business to that company. To some extent, we don't yet have that with technology, but I think we could start demanding that companies use friendly tech policies that are friendly to their consumers. We don't have that as even, you know, an issue on our radar at this point. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book. So that could then end up making financial sense for these companies to perhaps lose a small amount in profits, but to show that they're actually considering their consumers in the long run. That's important.
So sustainable, just like we want to buy products that have a lighter footprint on the earth, so-called sustainable products. And we've done shows on this. There's a lot of sort of greenwashing around that as well. But you're saying sustainable tech.
Yeah, sustainable tech basically is tech that the users of that tech are better off in the long run. It makes their lives better. It doesn't make their lives worse. It doesn't encroach on other aspects of their lives. It's not designed to hook them. The primary goal is not to ensure that they don't do other things that are important in their lives. It should be a complement to their lives. And ultimately, we need to demand that as consumers. And then perhaps at some point, we may need legislation the way France has instituted legislation for email. I'm loath to suggest that. I know this country prizes freedom, and the idea of curtailing people's usage of tech devices because in the main we just aren't very good at controlling our impulses seems a little unpalatable, but it's something that I think we could consider. It's a conversation worth having.
You know, I sort of hear your analogy on the sustainable environmental products, and could we demand products as consumers that are sustainable, that, you know, allow us to disengage and move our bodies and get outside and engage with real human beings. But if so many people are addicted, Adam, they're not going to want to buy those products. They're going to say, yuck, that phone shuts off after 10 hours.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why, you know, humans are fallible, as I've said a number of times. It's one of the reasons why this probably needs to start with the companies themselves, and why either legislation or a change in policies needs to be considered.
One last quickie question for you, Adam, and it comes from JP. With other addictive substances such as alcohol, there are specific limits recommended from medical groups such as the CDC. Are there similar recommendations for tech? It's a great question, JP.
It is an excellent question. At this stage, no, there are no specific limitations, and that's because I think we just don't know yet. All of these experiences are pretty young. Facebook's only 13 years old. And so we're getting a handle on it, and I think we're starting to develop some stronger norms, and we'll get there.
All right. Adam, it's really been nice to talk to you. Thank you very much for giving us an hour of your day.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura. I appreciate it.
It's Adam Alter. His book is Irresistible: The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.